From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Few people will regret seeing the back of 2021. It was supposed to be the year of recovery from COVID, but turned out to be just another stage in the pandemic. But once again, people are looking forward optimistically to a better year in 2022, and perhaps a little less enthusiastically to the federal election that will come by May. With an eye to that election, we talk today to two guests. Sean Kelly, who formerly worked for Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd, has just published a book on the Prime Minister titled The Game, A Portrait of Scott Morrison. And also Anne Tiernan, adjunct professor at Griffith University in Queensland, who is co-editor of the recently published Oxford Handbook of Australian Politics. Anne and Sean, thank you for joining us. Let's start with the question of how you see the year ending and how you see 2022 beginning for both the government and Labor. Anne, you might start.
Thanks, Michelle. Look, 2021 didn't get off to a great start for the government. That really started with Grace Tame being named Australian of the Year, one of four women honoured at that ceremony. And then the Brittany Higgins story broke in February after that. The PM spent a lot of time on the back foot. And he's in much the same place on gender at the end of the political year with the Set the Standard report delivered by the Sex Discrimination Commissioner in the last week of Parliament. And I think his handling of the member for Bass, Bridget Archer's decision to cross the floor on the Federal Integrity Commission bill by Helen Haynes was just indicative of an issue that had dogged him all year. What's really interesting at the end of the year from where the Prime Minister started is the disunity that started to appear on the coalition side around the emissions reduction targets and then more recently over vaccine mandates. So this is, you know, very interesting for a PM in his office, and Sean's written about this, of course, that likes to enforce unity and discipline, and that's really being challenged. You know, pretty messy, including with the Alan Tudge stepping aside and then the Gladys Fulwieringa story last week, including Morrison's, you know, pretty extraordinary attacks on the New South Wales ICAC. So there's a bunch of things that are going on at the end of the year that echo what happened at the beginning of the year. But I think, you know, the disunity and questions and his falling popularity is reflected in the published polls. So he's not, you know, necessarily any longer seen as the miracle election winner. And I think that's, you know, a very interesting place for him to be approaching another summer.
Sean, what's your take on this?
I think it's been a remarkably bad political year for Scott Morrison. There have been a series of extended periods of great political difficulty with the start of the year, then with the vaccines mess, and more recently, I think the last 6 weeks are probably as bad a period as Scott Morrison has faced during his prime ministership. But at the same time, Michelle, I think you know, the government is not as badly off as you might expect them to be with that combination of circumstances. Scott Morrison's approval ratings are not great, but they're a very long way from disastrous. And I think you have to ask as well, you know, the last 3 weeks have looked very messy for the government. The disunity in Parliament is a sign definitely of backbenchers beginning to be a little bit worried and trying to protect their own backs going into the election, not necessarily thinking that Scott Morrison is a shield, rather thinking that they need to create their own brand that is separate from Scott Morrison. But that concern, I don't think, has quite spread into desperation. It certainly hasn't spread into desperation at more senior levels of the government yet. And so I think really, given everything the government has gone through this year, it's very interesting that they're not in a terrible position going into the next year. In fact, I'd say they're in with a very strong shot.
Now, Sean, you've written very critically of the Prime Minister's character. How much do you think that the skin he's lost on the character front will count, or when push comes to shove, will the economic issues really put that aside? And, of course, we're about to get good economic figures in this week's budget update.
I think there are two elements of the character debate that are worth noting. The first is that all of the attacks on Scott Morrison as somebody who is loose with the truth, and Labor has stepped that up into outright calling him a liar recently, I don't think that's an election-winning thing at all, but I do think it helps inoculate Labor against attacks. One of Scott Morrison's favourite tactics is to paint the opposition. He's very effective at conjuring up villains, if you like. And I think the sense that what he's saying might not be as credible as it seemed once upon a time really makes that far more difficult for him. The second element is I think it opens a door, if you like. Creates a space that Anthony Albanese could step into. I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction with Scott Morrison now. I don't think it's yet clear that people are necessarily rushing to replace Morrison with Labor, though. So I think it's certainly done Morrison damage, but I think it's far from a fatal blow at this point. And that brings me to the really important part of your question, Michelle, which is about the economic debate. Scott Morrison's campaigning prowess, I think, you know, it's talked in very broad about in very broad terms, but I think the really sharp end of it is that he is very good at narrowing the field of play. He's very good at saying at shutting out all other things and saying this is what we are going to be talking about, and he's very good at commanding the national debate to follow his lead. And if he can do that in the early part of the year and bring everything back to the economy, then that could very well work for him. The budget is a small part of that strategy, but I think the far greater part of that strategy is simply his ability to shut everything else out, to cast off distractions and to dominate the field.
And a lot of the debate about policy in recent weeks and months, if not the whole year, has been about climate and climate policy. How important do you think this will be at the election? Will it be as important as last time? Or do you think people now see the two sides substantially converging on this issue?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, Michelle. It's not 2019. Business and community attitudes have really shifted significantly since then, and I think for the most part that's in favour of stronger action. The signals from global finance and our trading partners are very clear about all of this, and I think too that communities are attentive to the increased incidence and severity of natural disaster risks. So we've got floods, fires, heat waves, and all of the pandemic kind of risks front of mind in people's minds on the climate. And important groups like the Business Council, the National Farmers Federation, and others, have backed stronger targets than either of the major parties have committed to. Of course, the current crossbench and the new crop of community independent candidates have climate action at the top of their priorities alongside integrity and gender equality, of course. And I think what's really interesting in 2022 is that the states and territories are taking a lot of action around the move towards net zero, and they're at various stages of implementation of their renewable energy and economic transition strategies. And they're investing in regions that are most exposed to emission-intensive industries. So I think the New South Wales government is leaning pretty aggressively into that transition and has made no secret of its frustration with the federal government around, you know, electric vehicles or targets or whatever. So I think it's very different to how it looked in 2019, but concerns remain, of course, about how those new jobs and opportunities are going to materialise in affected communities, Hunter, the Bowen Basin, Western Australia and the Latrobe Valley. But I do think there is a stronger sense of the potential upsides for regional Australia. And I think the fact that there are tangible initiatives underway that can be pointed to might help to mitigate some of the concerns that the coalition tapped into so effectively in 2019. That doesn't mean those seats will go Labor's way, but I think it'll be a different debate in 2022 to the one that it was in 2019.
Sean, Anne mentioned the independent candidates, and there's a whole group of them. They're well funded. They're mostly targeting Liberal moderates. Do you see a likelihood that any of these candidates will win, that is the new independents, we're not talking about those already there, or will they just create some campaign grief for the government?
Well, look, I certainly wouldn't rule it out. But Michelle, I heard you saying this week that it's very difficult for independents to win in our system. And of course, that's true. So I certainly, if I was an independent supporter, I certainly wouldn't be getting too excited at this stage of the electoral cycle. What I think they bring to the campaign, though, is a little bit like the trouble the Greens have created for Labor over a number of years. The Greens make it difficult for Labor because Labor are effectively being attacked from both the left and the right, and then Labor feels the need to satisfy both of those elements of the electorate. And I think the independents make the job similarly difficult for the coalition. And you are beginning to see signs of that in the parliament, in the muscling up, or at least the rhetorical muscling up of the moderate wing of the Liberal Party. There is a sense now that people in the party, that MPs, are being attacked from both the right and the left. And I think that creates difficulty for any party because it creates confusion within that party about exactly what it stands for, and it potentially creates disunity as, to go back to an earlier part of this conversation, people feel the need to mark out their own brands. So I think that's probably the largest effect the independents are likely to have, unless, of course, we do end up in a hung parliament situation, in which case suddenly the independents become very important indeed.
How do you think they might handle a hung parliament? I noticed that the existing independents seem a bit anxious to say, well, we wouldn't enter formal agreements. What do you think would happen, Sean?
Well, yes, I mean, I think in a sense, everybody has been scarred in different ways by the experience of a hung parliament and formal agreements that the Gillard government went through. I think the independents don't want to repeat the experience of the independents then. And I think Labor certainly doesn't want to repeat the experience. So everybody on all sides is saying no chance for formal agreement. But you know, push comes to shove. I have no idea what any of the groups would do, independents, Greens, Liberal, Labor. Perhaps they will find ways not to enter into formal agreements. But, you know, in a fight for power, in a fight post an election for the chance to run the country for 3 years and to sit on the government benches, you would have to say for everybody involved, they will find a way around the technical things they might have refused at this point.
Well, you were there in those days in the Gillard government. Are they wise to keep their powder dry now?
I think they are, absolutely. Because obviously the seats they're running in, a lot of these independents are in electorates that are dominated by Liberal-leaning voters. And that means that if they enter into an agreement with Labor, that's very likely going to be unpopular in their electorate. But they're in a tricky position because they're running so hard on climate change, and the coalition obviously have a very poor record on climate change. So, in a way, they've skewered themselves. You know, they're damned if they go with the Liberal Party. They're damned if they go with the Labor Party, and that's probably why it's a very good reason to avoid formal agreements. But at the end of the day, if we end up in a hung parliament, and I am very far from convinced that we will, but if we do, they're going to have to choose a prime minister somehow.
And let's turn to Queensland, where you are and where the border is just reopening as we speak. Can you give us some picture of what's going on in Queensland? Now, Labor is obviously at rock bottom in terms of seats there, and yet it's a vital state. The coalition needs to hold its numbers. Labor needs to win some seats. And also, what about the fringe parties who have become very active there?
Well, of course, Michelle, as you know very well, there's many, many different Queenslands at election time, and it's always really hard to know what's happening across the great diversity of the state. The polls are saying that Labor's tracking positively off that terrible performance in 2019. And I think last week's Roy Morgan poll showed a swing of 12.9% to Labor since the last election. Now, how that translates, of course, into individual contests remains to be seen. But it'll be hoping to leverage the state government's popularity and the relative lack of COVID restrictions. Anastasia Palaszczuk won seats in her most recent election in places that don't normally vote for Labor. So I think the federal party will be looking at that very closely. But, you know, the borders have just opened, as you said, and the state will have its first experience of significant numbers of COVID infections. And there are questions about the health system's capacity, which is already under pressure to cope with that. So, you know, health is always a really difficult issue for state governments, and you know, I don't anticipate that will be any different now that, you know, COVID is inevitably going to come. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Scott Morrison is received. He's been unable to visit Queensland due to the border restrictions. The Prime Minister for New South Wales tag is really well crafted for a Queensland audience and perhaps sharpened by the Berejiklian invitation to contest Warringah last week. Anastasia Palaszczuk remains popular, and I think that's going to be very interesting to see how they kind of mobilise that, given there is presumably a war chest of footage showing him being very critical of her. Anthony Albanese has already arrived in Queensland. He's out in the media and campaigning, and he's been able to be here a few times. I don't think Labor is optimistic of picking up too many seats, and I actually think that the real contest is going to be in New South Wales and Victoria in a way that, and Western Australia, of course, in a way that, you know, Queensland's been the focus for the last few elections. I think it's hoping to regain Longman, and it's running some strong candidates in and around the seat of Flynn. The Shadow Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, who's a Queenslander, of course, and the Senate team have been really busy calibrating their messages around training and skills and bringing back manufacturing in Wide Bay. So, but, you know, as a consequence of 2019, others like Capricornia that were marginal are on pretty safe margins. So it's quite difficult for Labor, I think, in some ways.
But there are big swings always in Queensland, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. But, of course, the big wild card, and you talked about the fringe parties to come to that, I can't see One Nation performing as strongly as it did in 2019. But the real unknown wild card is the Palmer United Party. You have to see the billboards and the carpet bombing of advertising everywhere. They've spent a lot of money. So it's really difficult to know how that's going to break. And I think some of these uncertainties around the pandemic management. The economy in Cairns and Far North Queensland is in terrible shape. So, you know, it'll be very interesting to see how those contests kind of play out. I think Labor is going to come under some pressure in some of the inner city seats. I think the Green vote in Griffith, for example, could pose it a real challenge. But again, Brisbane and Ryan, which are held by the LNP, you know, there's a bit of overlap with Green votes there at the state and council levels. So I think, you know, it's going to be state by state. We've got seat by seat. We've got lots of people retiring, lots of sitting members retiring, George Christensen in Dawson, Andrew Lamming in Bowman and others. So, you know, it could be very interesting depending on the candidate.
Talking of people and the reception they get, or you mentioned the Prime Minister, what about Barnaby Joyce? Now, he's not in Queensland campaigning. He's still holed up in the United States with COVID in quarantine, but he used to be so popular in Queensland. Is he still popular, or is he a diminished figure now?
I think he's still popular with a very particular cohort of men who he seeks to appeal to. I'm not sure how his popularity will hold up. You know, Queensland is diverse and diversifying, and, you know, seats that once, you know, we're all about coal mines and whatever are now significantly made up by, you know, health, education, social services. So I think we've got to really look at the nuance of individual seats. But, you know, the coalition based their campaign headquarters in Queensland in 2019, and they did a very good job. So they've got, you know, they've got a real insight into the things that are going to appeal. But I don't imagine that Barnaby Joyce is going to be one of them.
Sean, let's talk about the Greens. They have 9 senators at the moment, and only 3 of them are up for re-election. Adam Bandt's hopeful they can pick up 3 in the other states, which would give them a dozen. What do you see as their prospects? And Labor says that it wouldn't do any deals with them, but do you think that they would be able to pressure a Labor government on policies given that sort of Senate representation if they could achieve that?
Well, look, first up, if it's difficult to pick the winner of an election and a dicey thing to attempt to do, trying to pick the exact makeup of the Senate, I think, is an even dicier thing to do. So I'm not sure I will give you much satisfaction on that front. But I do think broadly that the Greens are fairly well positioned going into this election. And they are well positioned simply because I think there is a reasonable amount of disillusionment on the left with both of the major parties in terms of their action on climate change. So I think the Greens have a very, very simple campaign in that sense. That said, I'm not sure that they are running a smart race in terms of talking about agreements with Labor and pushing Labor, because I think that many of those people on the left who would like both of the parties to act more on climate change would also probably be very worried about damage to Labor. I think a lot of those people are probably pretty frustrated with Scott Morrison at this point. Now, you get to this question about whether the Greens would have any influence on a Labor government's climate policy. I think you, as I was suggesting before, in general, you have to be sceptical of things parties and any MP says about what they would or wouldn't do in a hung parliament situation. But I actually do think Labor would run a million miles before allowing the Greens to swing them on their target. I think that if Labor won the election, they would feel so lucky, so fortunate to be back in government, that there is no way that they would risk a repeat of what happened the last time that they allowed the Greens to swing them on climate. In fact, they would try very hard, I suspect, to make a virtue out of not being swung by the Greens. They would use that to position themselves in the first term of a Labor government as a very clearly moderate government, as a centrist government. And that may well work for them. Now, the other element here is, where will Labor actually end in terms of what it will do on climate? And my guess is that Labor in government would end up being a bit bolder than Labor in opposition. That might not manifest in policies those first 3 years. It might manifest in a stronger target or a stronger suite of policies taken to an election. But I think, of course, I could be wrong, but my hunch would be Labor would get tougher on climate over time. My hunch would be both of the major parties would, because that's the way the world is tending. That's the way the political environment is shifting.
And you mentioned early on women's issues and what had happened in relation to women during this year. Do you think that there's going to be a significant women's vote at this election on women's issues, or influenced by women's issues?
Look, I think if there's ever going to be that influence on an election, it'll be in 2022, Michelle. I think, you know, the polls suggest Morrison has a very poor standing with female voters. And of course, Barnaby Joyce only exacerbates that. And that extraordinary anger that we saw earlier in the year, which saw women march for justice around the country, I don't think has necessarily dissipated. It's not as focused as it was, but it's certainly still there. And I think the government's going to be under pressure to respond to the appalling culture, the recommendations around the appalling culture of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Workplace revealed the other week. Vivian Tom's investigation into the allegations of bullying and harassment against Alan Tudge are ongoing. I think Labor will highlight the relative diversity in its ranks compared with the government. And I think the community independents, all of whom are experienced professional women, will try to do that too. But I think on the policy front, so it's tempting to kind of say, oh, well, you know, women's rage will be channeled into an anti-government vote. I'm not sure that that's so, but I think it's something that people will take into account. But on the policy front, women are very aware that they've borne the brunt of the pandemic and that significant reform and change is needed. And I think on cost of living issues, which is where Labor really wants to focus, women are acutely conscious of the pressures on families and the essential workers on whom their capacity to participate often depends. So I think, you know, the parties will be working very hard on that voter. I read a quote on the weekend that from a Liberal, you know, party who's a member who said, oh, look, you know, the doctor's wives have now become the candidates. So I think the women's vote will be very interesting. And particularly older women looking at housing affordability and some of the concerns, you know, for younger people. And we saw that in reaction to the 2014 budget. So I think, you know, the women's vote will be very interesting, and I'll be fascinated to see where it goes.
Just want to end by asking you both, what's your impression of how voters are feeling after 2 years of COVID, and how will this influence their thinking? Will they be more impatient of the politicians? Will they opt out of thinking about their vote until very late? What are your impressions? Sean, perhaps if you start.
I think you were always going to face a fork in the road politically after COVID. And it was going to be either, right, this pandemic has shone a large spotlight on significant problems in our society, Now the parties are going to try to rebuild from that and fix those problems. Or we were going to land at a point where people were utterly sick of the pandemic, utterly sick of thinking about politics, and just wanted to move on into a world where they didn't have to think about much at all. And I think we've ended up much more in that latter space. And I think that's a matter of timing. You know, if you look at the American election that saw Joe Biden get elected, obviously there were a lot of factors involved, but one of them was the fact that we were at an earlier point of the pandemic. And I think those arguments around change being needed in society were still much more current. Right? As I think at this point in the pandemic, there is just around the world and certainly in Australia, a mood of exhaustion. And so I think you have the government, Scott Morrison in particular, very strongly playing to that mood in talking about getting governments out of our faces and basically hoping not to do very much. And you have Labor, which I think is trying to do a little bit of each. It's trying to talk about building back better and taking some of the lessons from the pandemic, but it's also obviously quite cautious of scaring voters with the idea that government's going to be very active in a period in which they're quite sick of government. And so it's, you know, it's talking about renewal, not revolution, and those types of phrases. And, you know, it's very hard to tell. Morrison's message is obviously far simpler, far sharper, and a simpler, sharper message goes a long way in politics. Perhaps Albanese is giving people a little bit of the two things they both want. Perhaps that works, or perhaps it's confusing. I'm not sure.
Anne, what do you think?
Oh, well, I agree that people are exhausted and over it, but I think we have to understand the different experiences of different parts of Australia. So it's really clear that exhaustion and get government out of our lives thing is very strong in Victoria and New South Wales. It may be that the essentially COVID-free states over the last period of time are going to find themselves facing some real difficulties as they open up. And so that they'll be in a whole other set of expectations. I don't necessarily buy the get government out of our lives piece. I think in parts of Australia, people have been pretty glad that a strong public sector has stepped in and managed to get services delivered and avoided, deaths. And of course, the government, federal government, has talked this up very strongly. Its role, trying to kind of challenge the stroll out narrative. But I think, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, and this campaign is going to be so fascinating because of the many different micro campaigns that are going to have to run across the country. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how far the government can go on pork barreling and integrity questions, because that's lingering around. So will they? I see Barnaby Joyce had announced a new round of community grants to go out. So I think, I don't believe they'll be constrained, but I think the public's attitude to that will be quite different. And I think, again, I reference the disasters because they're already on foot, and we've got many more forecast over the period ahead. So I think it'll be, I think there's lots of different factors that are going to weigh on the campaign and going to shape those outcomes in individual seats. But, so often politics is framed through the prism of the experience of the southeast of the country. I don't think that's necessarily going to be how it plays out during the election.
Anne and Sean, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your insights. I'm not going to put you on the spot by asking for a prediction as to who will be in government this time next year. That's way too hard for all of us, I think. But thank you again, and thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. That's all for today's podcast, but we will be back with another one before we sign off for the year. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.
seeing the back of 2021. It was supposed to be the year of recovery from COVID, but turned out to be just another stage in the pandemic. But once again, people are looking forward optimistically to a better year in 2022, and perhaps less enthusiastically to the federal election that it will bring by May. With an eye to that election, we talk today to two guests. Sean Kelly, who formerly worked for Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd, titled The Game, A Portrait of Scott Morrison. And Anne Tiernan is adjunct professor at Griffith University in Queensland, and she's just been the co-author of the recently published Oxford Handbook of Australian Politics. Still no good?
No, that was good.
I shouldn't say it had just been. And Anne Tiernan, adjunct professor at Griffith University in Queensland, who is the co-editor of the recently published Oxford Handbook of Australian Politics. That's the better one on that. I don't know. Look, let's just see how they, when you mix and match, how they seem.